Okay, we're back in Romans. I just realised I've made a really foolish kind of promise that I was going to make it nice and simple. Did I really say that? Yeah, I did, didn't I? Are you going to hold me to it? Oh dear, that is worrying. That is really, really worrying. I'll do my best. The chapter begins with another therefore, which if you were listening to Suzanne kind of last week, you'll remember she kind of says, you know, it's all about what is going on here. Is kind of a cumulative argument that what Paul says now is based on what has gone before. If I could have the next slide up. Thanks, Brian. Nope, that ain't the next slide. Nope. Have I lost a quote? Oh, well, you've seen all the slides. I'm a little worried. Let's just go back to the title. I've got slide here too. It should say, this is a quote from Anders Nygren. I said I was going to make this simple. Oh dear. Anders Nygren says, Romans 5 is the point where all the lines of Paul's thinking converges. It is the next slide. Sorry, it was on the title. So kind of what he's saying really is that chapters 1 to 4, Paul has been talking about salvation. He's been talking about how we need it, and he's been talking about how God provides it. And that's why we've had that therefore. But then after this chapter, which kind of acts as kind of a hinge to the book, he's going to go on and talk about not just how we're saved from sin, but how we're made like Jesus. He's going to go on and talk about our need of sanctification, to be made like Jesus, to be made holy. And he's going to talk about how God does that for us too. So that's kind of where we're going. And this chapter sits in the middle and links the two together. We'll have the next, we will have the next slide up now. Thanks. When we talked about doing Romans, we wanted to talk about kind of what it means to live as a Christian today, because we believe God's word speaks into our lives today, not just record something that happened 2,000 years ago. And we said we wanted to address some of the big issues that face us today. And at times when we read Romans, particularly when it gets a bit complicated, like that chapter, it can feel like it's a million miles away, or not just thousands of years ago, but another world almost. But it just seems to me that this does touch on some of the big issues that we face in our world today. And particularly today, it focuses on kind of two of the biggest issues that I think focus, that kind of address our society. The problem is, though, it is complicated. Barclay said, no passage is more difficult for us to understand today. And then Barclay goes on, it's because Paul expresses himself in a difficult way. Well, I'm just very grateful that I'm not alone in thinking that's the case. I mean, it is, I think, complex and it's confusing. And I really want to pick out two key themes that come out of what we've been reading. Come with the next slide, thanks. I know you've seen them all now. All the surprise has gone. Confess I'm a little bit fascinated by kind of the direction that medical research is going in our world. There are aspects of it that are a bit disturbing, but it's also, I think, quite exciting at times. It seems to me that increasingly medics and scientists are looking at DNA to try and make sense of what happens to our physical health. To predict the risk of particular illnesses to particular individuals, to kind of go beyond kind of the illness itself and understand its causes. It holds out hope for the future, but it kind of brings worries about genetic engineering and all of those things. And it seems to be that we're moving from treating the effects of illness to treating its causes. The problem with DNA, though, is that none of us get to choose our parents. I've got to be a bit careful what I say now, because my mother's listening. So apologies, mother. But there are a few genetic changes I might have wished to make. it would be really nice to have been 6 inches taller. It would... I'm glad you found that funny. It gets worse. It would also have been nice to have had hair that stayed around a little bit longer. You know, kind of. I mean, to be honest, if I was going to do a complete remodel, oh, my blue eyes, actually. Wouldn't I look striking and handsome with blue eyes? It would just transform me, wouldn't it? I'm glad some of you agree, you know. Well, if you know my mother, and if you knew my father, there is not much chance of me being any taller than I am. I often joke about the fact that I'm overweight and say, you know, the problem isn't I need to lose weight, I just need to get taller, but it doesn't seem to happen. I have a picture of my father on my office wall out there. The worrying thing is I seem to get to look like him more and more the older I get. I seem to kind of also end up acting like him more and more the older I get. I'll ponder whether that's a good thing later, because otherwise I could be in trouble over dinner if I say any more about that. I get increasingly like him. But I suspect I'm probably quite fortunate genetically. My mother's 95. My dad was in his 90s when he died. There's clearly longevity in our genes. And there are some things that matter a lot more than height or hair when people talk about DNA. Kind of, people are trying to understand some really serious things like, you know, our propensity towards cancer or dementia, things that can impact our lives much more than our height or our hair. No wonder it's such a significant area for research. Well, today I'm talking about not our physical DNA, but we could have the next slide, but our spiritual DNA. That's what Paul's dealing with in this chapter, our spiritual DNA. At first sight, the language seems antiquated. He talks a lot about, he alludes to Adam a lot. It feels like it's a million miles away from the world in which we live. Paul tells us, give the next slide up, thanks, that sin entered the world through one man and death through sin. And in the same way, death came to all because all sinned. Repeatedly, in this chapter, Paul traces our spiritual DNA to Adam. And if we could have the next slide. These are just some of the things that he picks up on. In verse 15 he says, for many died by the trespass of one. He means Adam. For many died by the trespass of one. Verse 16, the judgment followed one man's sin, Adam's, and brought condemnation. Verse 17, for if the trespass of one man, death reigned through that one man, again Adam. Consequently, verse 18, just as a result of one trespass was condemnation for all. He's kind of making a connection with us and our lives right back to the beginning of time and to Adam. Paul repeatedly refers to Adam in this passage. And to be honest, at first sight, it's almost like there could be nothing that's more irrelevant to modern life than that. Are we in fable? Are we in fact? How can that make any difference anyway? But in this chapter, we also find a contrast between Adam and Christ. Sin enters the world through one, life through the other. And it seems to me actually there are no bigger issues we face in our world than the ones that Paul is dealing with in this chapter. And the big one is the word that's on the screen now, sin. It's a very unfashionable, it's a very unpopular word, but it's one that we can't ignore. And I have to say, and you may get me wrong, I don't know if I care really, it seems to me Christians haven't helped how we use that word and how we talk about it, I think at times has been very unhelpful. I had a PCC meeting on Monday night. It went on to nigh on 11 o'clock. I rolled in and it's like, Carol's gone to bed. What am I going to do with myself? So you do the obvious thing. You turn the TV on. And at that stage, I've got to the point when actually that's about as much control as I've got. The TV is on. I can't even master changing the channel at that stage. So it's whatever is on the TV is what I'm going to watch. So after a very long meeting, what do? I find myself watching a documentary on hate preachers in America. Anyone else see it? I kind of hope most of you didn't, really. It was so disturbing. On one hand, at times, they could be utterly biblical. But talk about take the Bible out of context and only put one side of the story. It was horrific. So having been exhausted, I ended up just thoroughly depressed. To be quite frank, at the end of it, I'm not sure that I would want to be a Christian, actually, if that's what Christianity was meant to be about. And actually, kind of, if other people have watched it, actually, I'm not even sure I want to let anyone know I'm a Christian, if they might think that that's what I'm like. It was just utterly gross. And I think part of the problem is that a kind of, and we might not go to those extremes, but there is a tendency amongst Christians to kind of, to relate sin to things that other people do and not kind of look within ourselves. And also, I think, particularly to kind of relate sin to one particular area, and that's the sexual arena. And we talked about that when we were talking about Romans kind of 2, kind of earlier in this series, and kind of have a listen to that. We kind of focus on particular things that somehow are seen as the really bad things and the other things don't really matter. So I don't think Christians help. But that sadly doesn't mean we can ignore sin. Paul is saying that the propensity to sin is within all of us. It's part of our spiritual DNA. He kind of says it very boldly in Romans 3:23. Can I have the next slide? Thanks. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. There's no exemptions on that. And it seems to me there is no more modern problem than sin. And I don't think we can ignore it. I think many would want to. Sometimes when you write something, I may be doing this the wrong way round. So you might want to juggle the pieces I'm going to talk about and kind of see which way it makes sense most. But kind of, it seems to me that, you know, when I look around, I know a lot of really very nice people. And I have kind of conversations with lots of them. I mean, I know a lot of very loving and very caring and very actually morally upright people who really do, you know, do the right thing, even at times when it's costly to themselves. And so when we talk about sin, we kind of say, well, you know, how can, when people are like, you know, when we see people like that, kind of, you know, well, how does that relate to them? And I often will have conversations with people in that situation. Well, you know, I think I'm an okay sort of person. You know, is sin really an issue? I want to come back to that. I'm just going to miss the next out of my notes. I hope I don't forget that. How do we make the whole gulf between kind of that kind of, yeah, there are a lot of nice people in this world, and the fact that actually there are a lot of people that do some really quite horrible things in our world. There is this huge gulf between the two. I don't know how many of you saw the article from the New York Times that Ruth Radley shared on Facebook, I think last week. You know, she's just been back in Africa, having not been able to go back to southern Sudan. And I think her heart is breaking over the civil war in that country. And she came back from Uganda and straight away to an article in the New York Times, which was picking up on what was going on in Yei, which is where she'd been based in southern Sudan. And was saying that actually there is a real danger of a repeat of the Rwandan genocide. It's getting that bad out there. And I read the article, and it's gut-wrenchingly painful. Men being round up and tied up and put in huts, and the huts being set on fire and being burnt alive. Babies being macheted. Women being gang raped. And, the normal New York Times were saying, it's not on the level of Rwanda at the moment, but unless something happens soon, it could easily be another Rwanda or Burundi. You know, how do we make sense of that level of inhumanity? Or Syria. And, and believe me, don't get me wrong, I don't profess to understand it. I really do not understand the complexity of what's going on in Syria. But somewhere in it, I suspect, it's underlined by the difference between Sunni and Shia Muslims. And that, but actually there are pro-government bodies and anti-government bodies. And the reality of it is that there are so many innocent people that are being caught up in the middle of it. We're nice Western people. But it's very dangerous what you say when it's going to be on tape, isn't it? But actually, Russia is pretty much a European nation, and they're happily dropping bombs on Aleppo and not worrying about it. I guess it's easier to drop a bomb when you fire it from an aircraft carrier somewhere out in the sea than killing someone face to face. Are there graduations in evil and in violence? And how do we make sense of this divide? I remember years ago, first pondering this one when it was the Balkans, the breakup of Yugoslavia and the fighting between what became the different Balkan countries, Croats and Serbs, and that was equally shocking, and all the more shocking because actually it's next door to Italy, it's like it's almost in Europe, or it is in Europe, and. And I found myself thinking, how can people be doing that? And I found myself then wondering, well, actually, what would I do? What would I do if I had been born a Serb and a Croat had killed a member of my family? What would I do now if I was born a Dinka and the Nuer had murdered people in my family group? Would I turn the other cheek and forgive, or would I think it's okay to do the same back the other way? The gulf in our world seems enormous, but actually, is there a real difference between us besides the accident of birth or of geography and where we live our lives? And actually, for all of where I started with this unpacking, for all of the niceness about so many of us, do we always feel nice when we look within, when we find ourselves confronted with our actions and our motives, and our thoughts, Is it easy to stand up under that? Paul's words 2,000 years ago, I think, still speak into our world. Sin entered the world through one man, and death through sin. And in this way, death came to all men because all sinned. There is no more relevant issue in our world than sin, because it's at the heart of so much of the brokenness of our world. And so also is death, because it follows on from sin, and so also is life. If we go to the next slide. And this, to me, seems to be the other big issue we face in this world. And I'm sorry if I'm depressing you this morning. But what about life? And this equally fascinates me. And I'm going to try and be really sensitive in what I say. I hope I am. Because kind of some of this is quite emotive and quite difficult. I'm sure I'm not alone in being struck by the sadness of that 14-year-old girl who lost her battle with cancer but won her battle with the courts to have her body frozen so that she might live again. And I just, before I go any further, I just want to say, I just feel totally kind of sympathetic to that hope and desire. I cannot imagine what it would be like to be facing having your life taken away from you at 14, almost before it's begun. I can't get my head round kind of what that would be like. This passage has a thing or two to say about death. Death is the hardest thing any of us have to face. And I don't think it's ever easy to face it. You know, like a confession. When I was a young curate, I know that was a long time ago, and I was first asked to take funeral services. You know, you inevitably feel very inadequate and kind of wonder how you're going to cope. You often wonder what you're going to walk through when you walk through the door into someone's lives when they've been bereaved. And, you know, and the bottom line is there are no words to make it perfect and right again. It's, you know, it's painful and it's about being on a journey with them. But often one of my first questions to the funeral director was, how old was the person whose funeral I'm going to be taking? And somehow when they were kind of older and it kind of felt like it was more natural, somehow it kind of eased my sense of anxiety about what I might encounter. And I can still, for this day, remember going to meet this man in his late 80s who had just been widowed. And I can remember that kind of sense of relief, kind of, it won't be easy, but at least they've had he and his wife had a long life. I was totally unprepared for what I encountered when I walked through the door. I've rarely met someone so devastated. Rarely. He'd shared 60 years with his wife, and he was totally unprepared to be able to say goodbye. He was utterly devastated. It was also in some ways symptomatic of the world in which we live, in which we kind of compartmentalize death and try and pretend it happens out there and happens to other people and doesn't touch our lives. In as much as one of his questions was, why did this happen to me? And you know, you're speechless, aren't you? Because it's going to happen to all of us. There is no avoiding it. It's the one certainty in life. But why has this mattered to me? And he was totally lost without the person he'd shared his life with for 60 years. It's hard, even when it's kind of feels like it's the natural end because a long life has been lived. But we know as well that equally it isn't always like that. Often people are ripped from this life and ripped from our lives when they are not ready and we are not ready to let them go. It's like their death comes out of time and it's unnatural. I mean, it's only recently that I had to bury someone whose wedding I took, which was a really strange feeling to comfort a partner and a child, but also parents that had lost their daughter. And that's the wrong way round. You know, burying parents is hard, but burying one's children is devastating. And I know that some of you are in a really difficult time at the moment, making sense of a friend that's been taken from you out of time. And there aren't easy answers, and I wish I could kind of stand here before you with a nice, tidy, neat one. But, you know, we live in a world that is confronted by life and death. These are still the big issues that we deal with in our world just as much as they were in Paul's day. We live in a broken world, a fragile world, where life too is fragile. And please, again, this is not meant in any way sanctimoniously or flippantly. I think what saddened me most about the death of that young girl, and the desperation to live again, her desire to live on. Yeah, and as I said, it's the most natural desire in the world, isn't it? But it was what it revealed about our society, the changes that have taken place in our society. Kind of where did she look for to hope? And please, again, hear what I'm saying about this. You know, she looked, and I'm not saying all science is dodgy. We benefit from so much wondrous things that science can do to change and prolong and give us hope in the world in which we live. But she was putting her hopes on what is some fairly dodgy science. You know, people that were actually pretty much nothing more than amateurs doing the cryogenic side here before sending her off to America to have her body kept until something might happen at some point in the future. And what sort of future might she have come back into if that was to happen? But it seems like the science was pretty thin. Her hope was being built, it seems to me, on something incredibly insubstantial. And it feels so sad to me. Was there no one that could say to her, but yes, you can live again. Yes, you can live again. And it just seems to me it reflects kind of the world in which we live, where we base so much on science, and it's right that we should seek to really understand our world. And, you know, and there's no way I would stand in that. We also kind of live in a world that is dominated by kind of humanism, where the place for God has got smaller and smaller. And where once someone might have come alongside her and just said, but what about eternity? Yes, you can live again. Actually, that hope, it feels like, was never, you don't get any sense that that was offered, because the focus was on this slim hope, very, very slim hope, that somehow she could be resuscitated in the future and live again. Paul puts it powerfully here. Sin and death came through Adam, but life comes through Jesus. Through Adam comes condemnation, through Jesus comes justification. For the next slide, thanks. Just as the result of the one trespass was condemnation for all, so the result of one act of righteousness was justification that brings life for all. Scientists have yet to find a way to change our physical DNA. But Christ offers us a new spiritual DNA, a new identity, a new way to live, a new hope, the hope of eternity. And whenever you read about what comes through Adam in this passage, you also read about what comes through Jesus. And everything that Jesus does trumps everything that Adam did. All of the focus of this passage is on Jesus and on the cross, on what he achieved for us. It deals with the problem of sin and the problem of death. It offers us justification. It offers us freedom from sin. And it offers us life. Let's pray. Lord, we are frequently weighed down by this broken world. whether it's the things that we see on our news that are happening thousands of miles away. Or whether it's what's happening in the lives of those around us that we love, who are suffering and hurting and mourning. And we just thank you that Jesus came to break the power of sin, to destroy the power of death, and to offer us forgiveness and life. And Lord, I just want to pray that in this broken world, you would give us the confidence to offer that hope